Be good.
Well, hey, hi, hello. Welcome to the program. It's Andrew, bringing you this here Monkey Tooth podcast, and I'm taking a break from the Bombay Beach Biennale coverage. This gentleman that I'm about to introduce to you, I did not meet in the Salton Sea. I did not meet him in Southern California. I met him maybe 25, 30 minutes away from my house. He lives in San Francisco, and his name is John Ralston. And he is a self-described junk man. He is such a cool character that I met via Instagram, of all places. Everything that he puts out just kind of cracks me up. It's filled with humor and sadness and an awareness of stuff, our junk, what it means metaphorically, spiritually, philosophically, just physically. He's a hard-working, creative, hip guy that I'm very glad to be around now. Yeah, I just wanted to pick his brain about what he's doing out there, and I'm glad I did. So that's coming up real soon. Monday, I'm leaving. That'll be May the 6th, 2024. I'm driving from the San Francisco Bay Area to New York City. If you are anywhere in between here or there along the I-80 corridor, pretty much anywhere except for Des Moines, Iowa, reach out. Maybe you can come see me. Maybe I can come see you. Maybe you know somebody in that general area who's cool and would be a great guest on this here program. Huh? Maybe. All right. That's enough of me. If you got any questions, reach out mtp.dog/contact. That's our website, www.mtp.dog/contact. Let me know what's happening in your life. All right. Enjoy this episode with my new pal and yours, the junk man, John Ralston. Until next time, I hope you're doing fun and interesting things. Maybe I'll see you on the road.
I haven't even really explored podcasts.
Yeah. It's, as a guy who drives around all day, do you listen to a lot of radio?
No, all the radios are broken. Yeah.
What do you do? Are you just.
I sing Christmas songs.
That's nice. Keep those Christmas songs rolling, man. Somebody's got to be singing them. All right. Well, John Ralston, how do you spell your last name?
A lot of people would assume it's R-A, but it's R-O-L-S-T-O-N.
R-O-L-S-T-O-N. I'm one of those people that assumed that it was A-U or wait. Yeah.
Ralston Purina is the more famous iteration of Ralston.
Purina?
Ralston Purina, the cat food company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's R-A-L.
Okay. But R-O-L. What's the
Scottish? And it used to be R-A-U-L, and then it came to America, and it got all different directions.
Chopped around and made Americanized.
Yeah.
Well, I did not drive down to, where'd you say we are? What part of town is this?
Bayview. Hunter's Point.
All right. Didn't drive down to Bayview to talk to you about your name. I want to talk to you about your crazy business, man. Do you call it junk? Are you a junk hauler? What do you have a better name for?
I'm proud to say I'm a junk man.
You're a junk man.
Which in this woke society, you probably shouldn't gender it, but.
Oh yeah. Well, but you identify as a man.
I'm a cisgender junk man. I tell people.
And you identify the stuff that you picked up as junk. That's your prerogative to identify it however you like. It's been abandoned.
That's right. I get paid. So there are different ways to get into the junk world. You can be a picker, excuse me, a picker. And that's someone that goes around looking for things to buy, to resell to antiques dealers they're kind of like a middleman. Then you have a scrapper who's going around looking for metal.
Right.
And you have a junk man who is basically we're going to have that train going by all
it's
the time.
Charming. I don't mind it. Yeah.
When I'm feeling low, I'll call myself a private client garbage man.
Okay.
Because I'm not the public garbage man. A junk man is like on call, specific, usually larger projects. It's not household. It's not food waste and stuff. It's
right.
Let's clean out the garage. Let's get rid of the attic or junk.
What draws you in the most?
Well, if you give me a tragedy, I can find some work.
Yeah.
It's divorce, death, bankruptcy.
Yeah.
You know, the business just closed.
Right.
So occasionally, they got a better job and they moved to a different city or something and they're leaving stuff behind, or they got married and they're combining two houses into one, so there's excess. But for the most part, it's, yeah, some minor or major tragedy has happened they need to get rid of stuff.
And they call you. Like, you have an internet presence. Like, how are you getting business?
I've been doing this for 15 years, so I don't really advertise, although I have my Instagram, which I don't know if it directly gets me jobs, but I'm sure it does somehow. And I go to the flea market, and so people come up to me there sometimes and be like, hey, can you do this? But mostly it's just, what I found is to work with real estate agents and probate lawyers and personal organizers.
Right.
Because those are the people that are getting constant demand for my services. So
right.
They call me.
So what's your interest in this? Did you start, because you're not from here, but you've been here for, 25 years. So you're from New Hampshire. Did you have like a junk origin story?
Yeah. I have a father who's a bit of a hoarder, collector. He's into coins. Mm. And my mother would only let him put stuff in his den. But his den was like the typical hoarder thing where you can't walk on the floor because everything's stacked. But it was contained into one area. And I also feel like when I was in grade school, it was the grade school and then a soccer field and then the cemetery and then the town dump. So after school, we could go over and play in the dump and you would just be smashing things and discovering things. And that was always super thrilling. The treasure hunt and the recklessness of smashing things.
You don't have to be careful.
Yeah, you don't have to be careful. It's like a little ADHD boys.
Yeah.
It's a dream world.
It's a dream.
So I always enjoyed the dump. And then when I came to California, I was on the peninsula and doing like laboring for a guy. And I don't know how that turns into it. Oh, I remember we cleaned out a barn one time and I was like, oh, this is awesome. Because you find like just the coolest old stuff. But I didn't know about like flea markets. I didn't know about the resale part of it.
Right.
So you kind of can only collect a little bit and then you're at your limit. And then I came up to the city and I was trying to be in construction in the city. And I was the only guy with a truck on the crew. Like the carpenter would take the bus with his tool bags and just.
Wow.
So if they needed a lumber run, they sent me. If they needed a dump run, they sent me. So then I started going to the dump a lot. And at the dump, I found out that there's an artist in residence program at the San Francisco dump.
What?
Yeah, you can apply and they give you a 3-month stay at the dump. You don't live there, but you go there, you pick through the junk. They have a studio where you go back and make stuff. And then at the end of that, they give you an art show and you have an opening.
What? That's super cool.
Yeah. So I got introduced to the people in charge of that and I started going to their art shows and talking to the director, and he said, well, I could create a student residency, because I wasn't an artist, but I was just like obviously really into junk. You could tell I really had a problem. So I was going to state. I was working on a poetry degree. So nice. So I got in that way. I got in as a student artist and hanging out on the tipping floor, they call it, where you go in and you just throw the garbage on the ground. So there was a woman that would come in like an old bread truck and she would stand there and point to her two helpers and be like, save that. Don't get rid of that. And I was like, what is she doing? What is this magical job?
Lording over the trash.
Totally. Yes. That's great. And that's when it all crystallized. I was like, oh, that's what a chunk man is. Of course, it was a lesbian who introduced it to me, which is a great origin story.
Even better. It's perfect.
So because I found out, because later on when I discovered the flea market, which is the critical part of the beginning junk man's journey, is you have to understand, you got to get rid of this stuff because your garage will fill up in like 2 months.
Yeah.
And I was doing yard sales at my house, but then you realize it's the same circuit. It's the same six people showing up.
Yeah.
And they'll come and buy a little bit, but you're not getting rid of the volume you need to.
Yeah. And they're going to the flea market.
They're taking it to the flea market.
Yes, show totally. Up like 20 minutes before you're ready.
Right. They're knocking guys. On my door.
Yeah, yeah.
Because back then I was definitely hungover.
Yeah.
So I did the yard sale at my house. Then I started going to my friends' yard houses and having a yard sale there, trying to get new
six dudes.
Yeah, different six dudes. Yeah. And there's always a couple ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
I
don't mean to exclude anyone. Sorry.
Well, junk. I can't think of any. Gender is. I'm always nervous about calling myself a junk man or like making these blanket statements because. But going to the cardboard drop off, going to the metal yard, it's 99% men. There's one cardboard lady in the city that I know is this Chinese woman. And I've seen her, like I've worked with her. I've been at places where she's come and collected cardboard and she's got this, maybe it's her husband. It's someone she just verbally abuses. It's awesome. So she's almost like a pretty manly lady in that aspect. I'm starting to lose the
You're digging a
here.
Hole with this gender thing, man. We can just drop it. I'll tell you this. I'm not judging you. I'm more interested in the art of what you're doing, that you're this sort of errant poet, construction guy with a truck who has found, like you allowed yourself to see the magic in junk. Or junk is such a goofball word, but like
no, it is.
The things discarded.
Yeah.
You know, there is a poetry in that. That was kind of your in, and you've needed to like make dough. I guess you need to make some money.
I had a poetry degree.
You have a poetry.
I was working on it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I needed money. I was actually in the MFA program, and I was like halfway through that, and I was like, okay, I'm really just avoiding the inevitable. I gotta go get a job. Staying here another 2 years is not gonna improve anything.
But you're not afraid of hard work, obviously. Because hauling stuff around, especially in San Francisco, there's going to be hills, there's going to be stairs. You're obviously busting ass all day long. Are you running around the truck by yourself or do you have guys with you?
Originally, it was just me. And then there was a coffee shop. This is 2005 or something. I don't know. Things weren't, I think we just went, what, 2008 was when the burst. It burst.
Yeah, the economy busted.
So probably right around then. There was a coffee shop called Simple Pleasures in the outer Richmond district where I lived at the time. And you would just go there and it was like the labor hall. I'd pull up in the truck and be like, hey, I need some help. Who wants to go make some money? And we all knew each other. Somebody would, there's like all the guys in bands were hanging out there, starting to wake up. And so somebody or two people would jump in the truck and we'd go do it. And it was super fun and carefree. There was no IRS involved in any of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I had the truck and then my garage was full and the flea market started doing the flea markets. And then the best thing I ever did was write a 5-year plan. And I was like, all right, I remember being on my diesel Ford F-250, 1986, the two-tone cream and brown. Oh
nice.
My God, I love that.
I love that truck. I know that truck. Yeah. My dad had one.
And, I was on top of this pile of pricker bushes and I was like, oh, do you really want to do this the rest of your life? Like I was like bleeding and like my back hurt. Mm. I was just inside the tipping floor area and stinks. And it's like, yeah, I guess this is it. It was like, yeah, this is what I got to do. It sucks. It can have really shitty moments, but I do love it. And I really remember that as being like, what else am I going to do? Like, I can't go. I had tried to get a job downtown because I kind of had this other part of me that wanted to work in an office.
Yeah.
That was like so fascinating to me. Yeah. And I remember applying to a couple jobs and I just, I knew I was a freak in that situation.
Yeah.
And they knew.
Yeah.
There's no way
they can't hide it. You can't hide it.
Not hide it. So I was just like, I don't know what else I could do. I better just stick with this and make it work.
Yeah.
And so it grew from there. You know, I got it took me a long time to get a dump truck, a dump body, open top, stake bed thing. And because I went right into driving the Isuzu NPR box trucks because they have this super tight turning radius.
Yeah, those are awesome.
They're a dream for the city.
Yeah.
And while I was at San Francisco State, I was working on the photo shoots for Williams Sonoma as a merchandise coordinator, they called us. We would basically just pack the furniture into a truck, drive over to Marin to somebody's house, move their nice stuff out, put the shitty Pottery Barn stuff in, take some pictures, pack it up, take it back to the warehouse.
All right.
So I really knew the NPR really well. And I was like, that was the truck I just assumed I would buy. And I was afraid of people stealing my garbage. I was worried about rain and all that. So it took me years before I finally bought a dump truck. And then I realized that's the only way to go.
Yeah.
Just in and out of the dump.
Right.
So I don't know where that story was going either.
Well, I brought it. I was curious what your origin story was. And the trajectory is that you've been, you know, trying to figure out your equipment, what it's going to be, what your staffing is going to be.
Yeah. I think I was saying I wrote a 5-year plan where I wanted to get.
You did write a 5-year plan.
I wanted a truck, and then I wanted somebody to help me. And then I wanted to get a warehouse. And so that 5-year plan took 15, but I'm here.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do now. yeah, I was able to buy a building with the government, the 504C loan or something like that. You only have to put 10% down for a business. And that was the only way. This was the second cheapest commercial property.
The building we're in now?
Yeah.
Wow.
At the time. It's now probably worth less than what I paid for it because I bought it during COVID.
And right.
Things have falling apart, but I'm in it for the long. I got 30 years for it to turn around.
You got time, man. You got time.
The junk is not slowing down.
No,
if everything else is. So the question was like, how did I get here? What or how does poetry fit into this journey?
Sort of. It was very indelicately worded. My curiosity about like you as a guy living here for 25 years.
Seeing the city change.
Seeing a change and get so like Melba toast and sadly, like, I mean, it's dangerous and there's a lot of sadness and a lot of like brutality in the streets, you know, from what I read in Marin safely in my little redwood forest and my newspaper, you know, but yeah, I think it'd be fair to say objectively, there's a lot of struggle in the city and you've seen it all. You've seen the boom and the bust.
Yeah, a couple times, really.
Yeah.
First came here in 92, and that's when it was like Haight Street was the cool place, and there was all the gutter punks, and the Mission was still mostly Latino. And
Real World San Francisco hadn't even happened yet.
Yeah.
Was it 92? I feel like that's like mid-90s, maybe.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, grunge was still coming.
Yeah.
Wow, 92.
And then I went and joined the Merchant Marines and I traveled around a bunch and I came, but I always had like, wow, San Francisco was a really magical, beautiful place, unlike most other places in the world.
Did you join the Merchant Marines from here? Or did you go back to New Hampshire?
I was back in New Hampshire and I had a friend from high school who did it and he showed me the path. There's a Union School in Maryland. Wow. So I went down to Piney Point, Maryland and went to the Seafarers International Union Training Academy. That was like quasi-military where you wear uniforms. And
you've got a chain of command, the same sort of thing. There's captains and all that,
raise the flag and
all
that stuff. But that was only like a month and a half or 2 months. And then you go out on a ship. And so I saw a bunch of the world and it was always the shitty side of the world that I saw. But that's the fun part.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just kept thinking about San Francisco. So I came back and it's hard to penetrate, really, if you don't have a job. And you, I've seen so many people come here and have to go back. And I guess I started off on the peninsula, and like, because I'm also a timid small town guy, and I couldn't imagine how you just walk into a city and,
hey, here I am.
Like, what
check
do I, yeah. And like, I'm from New Hampshire, and I never even went to New York. Like, that was a terrifying city to me. We would go to Boston sometimes, but not really a city kid, but it's so alluring. There's something so fascinating about the tall buildings and the lights and all the different ethnicities. Is really coming from rural New Hampshire. I was like, wow. And that's what's fascinating about going through their garbage. You're like, oh, this is Japanese garbage and this is Russian garbage. And,
wow.
You know, they're getting stuff sent from their home, or right. they brought stuff over, and you see like, what is this stuff?
Yeah.
Versus if I was a junk man in New Hampshire, it would be everybody's got
all the same stuff.
Everything's from Shaw's supermarket. And
right.
It's like, I don't know. It's just, it's been really cool to have that New Hampshire as something to compare things to, because everything seems bright and colorful when you compare it to New Hampshire.
Yeah. Coming from Mississippi and Tennessee, I can empathize with that a lot.
Yeah.
I lived in a building in Brooklyn, and I was counting the floors and how many apartments were on each floor. And then like thinking, okay, if there's like two people in each one, holy shit, there's more people in this one building than the neighborhood I grew up in.
Yeah.
Like way more. Like, that was mind blowing to me. You know, like, and it was, you know, I don't know. Is it like this in San Francisco where like, I don't know if it, I think it used to be more pronounced, but like, you know, in Brooklyn, it was like this neighborhood is largely Dominican. If you go two blocks over, that's mostly Puerto Rican. If you go that way, it's Hasidic Jews. If you go this way, you know, like it was kind of like big quadrants of ethnicities all in one spot. Is that still that way in San Francisco, or has it gotten more diffuse?
It has definitely gotten diffuse, especially here in Bayview. This was traditionally an African-American neighborhood since World War II, I think. They called it Butcher Town because there used to be cattle drives and the slaughterhouses were here. And so that was probably, I don't know, white people. And then I think there's a lot of Italians because they would, like, there's still salami factories down here. And
yeah.
So it was a lot of Italians and a lot of people from Malta, for some reason,
really?
were Maltese people were in this neighborhood. And then I think because World War II opened up, the Navy Yard is here.
Right.
So it employed a lot of black people and gave them an opportunity. So they settled here.
Right. Like in the Navy Yard that was busy, busy building naval ships, right? The Pacific Theater, everything, a lot of stuff was coming out of here and like Marine ships and.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really wild. So like this area now, like what is it? Is it just kind of everything?
It's transitioning from, it is probably 40% black now versus probably 80% black a few years ago. Because, well, colloquially, that's always been a hard word for
it's
me.
It's not an easy word. I think that poetry degree.
It was, you know, the crack epidemic. During the World War II era, that generation of black people were able to work, get jobs, make money, buy property around here. And there's a lot of people that their families have a couple homes. Mm-hmm. And then the generation that was young during the crack epidemic, they might inherit a house, but they basically smoked it away.
Right.
So now they became a lot of rental houses, and all of that equity is lost to that generation. And if you smoked your inheritance away and you have kids and you're addicted to crack, it just kind of like crack really messed this neighborhood up.
Yeah.
So we bought a house. We bought a house from a black family that the parents had died, and there's like six siblings. And they own, I think, six houses. They own a lot of property around here. but there was a lot of infighting. And I'm going to jump ahead to a recent legislation where it used to be when you died and you passed the property on to your kids, they could keep the tax basis. Mm-hmm. So your property taxes wouldn't go up if it stayed in the family.
Right.
And they just changed that a year or two ago. So now if you inherit a property,
You pay taxes on the new worth.
The new value. So you now have a...
Not the sale value, but just like an appraiser can come by and be like, that thing's worth $2 million.
Right.
And now your property tax goes from $3,000 a year to $50,000.
$50,000. So
that's crazy.
That's going to change the neighborhood a lot, or the whole city a lot.
The whole city, yeah.
And that's why...
Is that a California thing or is that just a San Francisco thing? It doesn't matter. I mean...
I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. It's taking people into the weeds on this... legislative.
I just heard, I've heard a couple people. It's a California thing because Someone I knew down on the peninsula back then, she just went through that.
Wow.
She had to sell a house because she couldn't afford to keep it. Mm. And I've gone to jobs and, you get talking to the people.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I'm going to try to hold on to the house, but I don't think I can. So.
Well, that's another thing about your job. Sorry. I know we're bouncing around all over the place, but, your own personal trajectory seems really interesting. I didn't know about the Merchant Marine thing. I mean, you've done a lot of, I would say, very specific shit that I don't know anybody else who's done. I don't know any other Merchant Marines. I don't know that I know what the Merchant Marines does.
It's just the guys on those ships out in the bay.
Like, are you just like moving things around in the ship? Or are you operating the ship? I mean,
there's three departments. There's the galley, which is the kitchen. There's the deck, which ties the ship up and loads and unloads. Mm-hmm. And then there's the engine room, which
makes it go.
Okay. Puts the gas in.
Yeah. You were a deck guy or were you cooking?
I was the first class in that training school. They made you used to go there and then go out and just get a job. But they had such a high turnover. They're like, okay, we're going to make them be cadets and pay them $18 a day. And they sail for 1 month in each department. Then they come back and decide which department they want to go. So I've been in all three departments.
Yeah.
And I chose galley.
Yeah, I think that's where I would go.
Because they said the galley is for the N words. Wow. And the F words. Blacks and gays, that's who goes to the galley.
Wow.
And I was like, those are the fun people.
Yeah, that's...
Because the deck was just the crankiest...
curmudgeonly like,
yeah.
dudes.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, it's just
they all
boring.
Wish they'd gone to the galley. Yeah. They wish they could. Seething resentment in there.
And I got kicked out of the engine room because I didn't realize it's a twin diesel on that first ship. And the diesel motor is the size of a school bus. There's two of these motors. And there was thing, and you're supposed to like you're a wiper. That's what they call your entry level. You go wipe things down because there's diesel fuel and oil all over the place.
Yeah.
And they give you a hose and you're like hosing things. I was like hosing down some apparently electrical part. And the
fried it.
The chief engineer saw me. He was like, get out of my engine room. Oh. And I got transferred out of that, which was great. You don't want to be in the engine. You're in an engine.
Loud.
Loud, hot, no air.
Yeah.
I mean, the deck was way better.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at clouds and the ocean.
I think I'd like galley. I tend to gravitate. I'm that dude who hangs out in the kitchen at parties.
Yeah.
You
want to be by the food.
I want to be by the food. I need a job. Like, it's very specific what you're doing in the kitchen. There's not a whole lot of ambiguity. You're either prepping or cooking or serving.
And I've done tons of dishwashing and stuff as a high school kid. So
yeah. All right. So thank you for clarifying my confusion about the Merchant Marines. Uh-huh. So back in San Francisco, you bought a house, you're in this neighborhood, feeling a part of it. How long have you been in this neighborhood? You said you bought this place during COVID, but...
My wife and I moved here, bought a place in 2013 and rented it out while we remodeled it.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 years later, we moved in. So 2016, I think we officially moved in.
It's a hell of a neighborhood, man. I'm just driving through here, like you got the streetcar. Is that the streetcar there? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's got a ton of charm and like your storefront is awesome. It's called the Still Good
Deli.
It's Still Good Deli. I love that. Is that your signage?
Yeah. Like, well, a guy that was living here I had an artist friend staying here, and he was supposed to make me a sign a month to stay here.
Yeah. You got how many to one?
I think you counted each letter as a sign. So I probably owe him money, I think.
Yeah. It's great. The one thing I've noticed about your internet presence is that you have kind of a wry sense of humor. You're kind of making fun of yourself a little, making fun of the city of San Francisco, but also showing a deep appreciation for the thing that gave it its character. Like all this old shit. I mean, the way houses are built here, the way that the things that people have collected. I mean, when I first got here, you were showing me some of the stuff that was in the back of your truck. And you definitely have an appreciation for not just vintage, but like well-made things. And San Francisco seems like one of those cities that's just like the craft carpentry that goes into everything. Like the way that they built stairways and things like that is so, so rich and so hip. And so like, I feel like your shop, which I haven't even gotten to see in person, I feel like your whole thing is like in a way honoring that, hey, here's stuff that was well built. It's still good. Come check it out.
Yeah. Still good.
Still good. I love that.
Why were they throwing it away? And San Francisco's since the gold rush has had more money than it knew what to do with. So you can afford nice things to be built or imported. And I guess being a junk man in a really poor part of the world is probably not as exciting.
Maybe not. Might not be.
Not to be classist or whatever, but it's because there's so many cultures here and the money and the fact that there's a lot of money. Like people just yesterday, I guess it was Friday, I did a job and they threw away like 20 Hermes boxes. They were empty, but I was like, oh, somebody's going to want those. So I took them to Alameda Flea Market and sold them for $150 for empty boxes. So that's the level of wealth when your discards, your cardboard recycling is worth $150. That's like, it's kind of mind-blowing. It's like eye-opening, mind-blowing, heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking. That leads me to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, because you do engage with a lot of people. I mean, you know, when you're going to collect stuff from a house, like you said, it's often tied to some sort of tragedy, you know, death, divorce, whatever, occasionally maybe a success.
Yeah.
But do you feel like people feel compelled to talk to you, or are you just naturally chatty? Like, how do you get these conversations happening?
I have to be careful because if I show too much interest, people get suspicious sometimes.
Right, right, right.
Especially. But I think also I'm just the junk man, so they can relax. They already usually rightfully assume they're in a better place than I am. So they can tell me, you know, their little story and stuff. And I think people want to share, especially at that moment. They're like, if I show an interest, like, what is that thing? Oh, that was my dad's. And he used to sit down here and carve these things, and you know, it's their stuff. So you, by showing an interest in it, you're showing an interest in them.
Yeah.
And if you, and that also, you have to be kind of careful about not smashing the shit to pieces right in front of them, or give them a little warning. I give them people a warning. I'm like,
I'm gonna throw some things.
We gotta break this down. I know that might hurt, but are you okay if we break it down so it'll fit on the truck?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh yeah, no problem.
I imagine it could be cathartic, or it could be like traumatizing.
Yeah. See. Usually like once they're like, wow, I wish I could be doing that.
Right.
I'm like, here's the sledgehammer. Go for it.
Take a swing.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, yeah, today, within 4 minutes of meeting you, you told me a story about a guy who had a stack of newspapers from, you know, the 1939. World War II. Yeah. And his parents had been in an internment camp.
He was it was Japanese American. He was American. I guess his parents had. That's the other thing. There's a huge Japanese population in San Francisco and up and down the peninsula, and they were famous for growing roses. This was like there used to be greenhouses out in the Excelsior. Just the whole area was greenhouses all down the peninsula. And they were growing roses and shipping them around the country. This is like the place to grow roses. It's like the perfect climate, right? So I don't know that this guy's family was involved in growing roses. In fact, he told me his dad was in the army when we declared war on Japan, and he got pulled out of the army and sent to a, they don't call them concentration camps. What do they call
internment.
Them? Internment camp. Thank you.
Yeah. What?
In Tool Lake. He told me the name of
it. Tuolumne. Yeah. It's
camp,
down.
Camp Tuolumne or something.
It's off of 395. I've driven past it.
Oh, yeah.
It's weird. It's like such a strange area to put people.
He said it was just getting to be winter when they got sent there.
Yeah.
His wife got sick and died. He said there was no real medical care at the beginning. So, So it's weird to pull out this newspaper, this stack of old newspapers, and you're like, oh, cool, U.S. bombs the Jap, or Japs bomb the bomb U.S.
Yeah, just a racial slur. Yeah,
right at the top. And I don't know what the font would be, or the, what do they call it, pica? Why do you...
Oh, yeah, the big, bold...
It was, yeah, it was like a six-inch letters across the top. Jap.
Jeez.
And I was like... And I saw, I was like, oh my God, your last name is Suzuki. You're Japanese. Your parents must have been interned. He's like, yeah. And he kind of wanted to talk about it and he kind of didn't.
Right.
And, but he told me that story. And he said after a few months, they came and said the army came back or the Air Force came and something. Somebody, they tried, they said, do you want to go? Well, you can get out of here if you go fight in the arm in the military. And he's like, I was. It's like, I think the undertext was he was done with America, helping America. Whoa, is that okay?
Yeah.
It's we'll good. Get used to it.
Just for context, listener, it got real dark in here. I didn't want to say anything. I was like, man, is this dude going to turn on the light?
I was getting sleepy.
We've just met. So we're sitting here in the dark, like, well, here we go, man. I'm talking about junk in the dark. But the things that are still good are the ones that, like, I mean, yeah, I know you can sell like a functional vacuum cleaner that doesn't necessarily have a story. And you can probably get a couple bucks off of that. That's good. But there, you also find all kinds of really cool shit. I saw one thing the other day, like this thick, like, I don't know if it was redwood or oak slab, and the feet were antlers.
That was from Mr. Suzuki.
That was wild.
His dad was in the garage making weird things.
Weird. So cool. It's like, what the hell? Like, that kind of stuff to me is like so hip.
Yeah.
Because you know that's a story, right?
God, I don't know where I put it. I found a homemade copper pipe bong.
A bong.
And it was just like a all copper pipe. They had the little elbow in there.
Wow.
And they had cut out a scoop so it like molded around your face. Because we were looking at it like, and it had a flat bottom. We're like, what kind of water
plumbing fitting
is it? And they're like, it looks like a bong. Oh, and it would sit down like a bong, and then it fits on your mouth like a bong.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, you see so much weird shit, and you're like, why did this ever get made? Some of it is like, this was someone's idea, and they took it to market, and it failed.
But here it is.
But it got shoved in this box.
Let's get it on eBay right away. So is that a big part of your thing now? I mean, you've got, so let's jump to the present.
Okay.
We're in this building, which is amazing. I mean, you've got like
about 5,000 square feet of junk.
Yeah. Third of a block. I mean, you've got a two-story building with a storefront, a whole warehousing situation.
Two-car garage. Yeah.
That's crazy. And but you also have like, the storefront is selling. You guys are what? Open on the weekends?
We closed the storefront down. I was open. I hired a guy to be the shopkeeper, and we just lost money every month.
Mm.
The problem is, Third Street out here doesn't have foot traffic.
Right.
It's got a lot of transitional housing. People getting out of prison. So these look like residential houses, but they're packed with like 15 ex-cons that are trying to get right. Yeah. And they're not allowed to be in the houses during the day. So if they don't have a job, they go out and sit on the street.
Mm.
And that's great. there's a lot of them, or I don't know who it is that's got all the mental illness around here, but I would think the traumas of prison might contribute to some destabilization.
I can imagine.
So I remember one time, Robert was the shopkeeper. He did great, made it look really cute, and he was really chill. And he was telling me about someone came in with a dog and it bit somebody else in the store. And Robert said he just put his head down and like looked at his Instagram and let them work it out. Like, there's just nothing you can do, you know?
Oh my
God. And I would come in and there's this one woman that, she was obviously had some psychosis going on, but he would let her come in and she would go sit down at the kitchen table. We were trying to sell. It was a little 50s dinette table like this. And she would just be asleep there with her bags.
Yeah.
And the shop was only about as big as this little kitchen here. Yeah. And it's like,
that's a lot of real estate in the tiny space. Yeah.
But nobody else is coming in anyway. So like, what do you do? And,
right.
And we had a big event one time. And we got some people from out of the neighborhood to come in and spend some money. And I was talking to this one woman and she was like, I do pottery. I was like, well, you should come in here. We'll sell some of your pottery. We'll have a little event. She was all excited. And then some crazy guy grabs her into this bear hug and then lets her go and acts like nothing's wrong. And I was like, hey, man, you can't do that. And then he just like runs out and her boyfriend's like, you can't have a pottery show here. And so that just fell apart. And it was just like, it's not necessarily a violent neighborhood, but it is not a retail friendly neighborhood.
Sure. Sure. So yeah, that was more trouble than it was worth.
I really wanted it to work because it seems like this is a neighborhood where people will come buy stuff, like still good stuff, even if it's just dishes and curtains or just simple things, because there's not a lot of shopping opportunity around here.
Right.
But I think that's already ingrained in people's heads. So they're not out looking. There's nothing else on Third Street to do, really. So unless you want to buy weed or Coke.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different weekend. So you just then now have kind of like a flip farm. You're flipping stuff. So you're just taking what's still good, getting it online and Craigslist, eBay, what all do you?
Yeah, I have an online sales team. I have Lem. He's from the neighborhood. He does the shipping and customer service. And then I have Brian. He's kind of like my savior. He's like just so into it. He came from Gus's, the supermarkets. He was like a manager of several of those locations. So he's used to chaos and stress and
And systems. Yeah, that's a good guy to have around.
So he's really turned it all around.
Nice.
So he's a big part of that. And then I have another guy, Chris, who comes in on the weekend and lists things. So between Brian and Chris, they list things on eBay and Facebook Marketplace. We do Craigslist, but it used to be you would do it on Craigslist because people our age and older still go to Craigslist. Younger than us, it's just Marketplace.
Really?
So if you have antique furniture, you might sell it on Craigslist because that's the people looking for it.
Yeah. But okay, it's good to know.
It's basically really fallen off. I used to do better on Craigslist and now it's shifted to Facebook. And some people are telling me to do OfferUp and some of these other platforms.
You just got to be constantly...
Yeah, nothing stays the same.
Nothing stays the same. As long as it's still good. I was thinking about like what you're doing. You know, I hate to keep trying to make it poetic, but it is, man. There's like I think about death a lot. Probably too much. Mm. You know, it's just...
Who did you lose?
My dad died, but I grew up my mom was a hospice nurse.
Oh,
so we talked about it all the time.
Yeah.
We just were present with the idea of being dead forever. And my sister was in town this weekend and we were both like, as soon as we sat down together and started talking, within a few minutes, we ended up talking about death, all the things that you like and the things that you're collecting and bringing into your house, like some sort of wizard you know, eventually will just be like stuff that someone else has to deal with. You know, I've had everything I own stolen. Mm-hmm. I came home from work one night and had been just basically moved out of my house.
Wow. They like brought a truck.
Oh, dude. They kicked in an air conditioner and all I had were instruments. Like,
oh,
they took,
shoot.
You know, five guitars, a cello, a banjo, every piece of music I'd ever recorded, every record, every CD I'd ever bought. It was before everybody had a computer, but I still have shit. It's not that I don't have any things, but my like level of attachment to those things is a little different. Mm-hmm. And I just see all my stuff. I get anxious about having stuff, if that makes sense. I'd rather have fewer things than more. But it seems like the more I get rid of stuff, the more things come back to me. It's a weird, there's a magnetism to stuff. And then you think about George Carlin's, how come everybody else's stuff is shit and all my shit is stuff? Mm-hmm. Get your shit away from my stuff. But there is a weird magnetism. Like things just find their way. And we do tend to hoard and, I don't know, collect stuff. I mean, you're sitting on 5,000 square feet of collection. Do you worry about your own death and who's going to collect it? Or are you just like, some guy's going to have a good time smashing it and throwing it in the trash and make what he can?
Yeah, I don't worry about my stuff. There's very little that I feel like is mine. Mm-hmm. Most of this is inventory. Mm-hmm. When I first started doing this, I would get to a job and immediately have to poop. It was like I was needing to make room to deal with what was about to happen.
Psychic weight.
I don't do that anymore. I just...
You found a way.
And another point would be, as soon as you open up a space by giving something away, that space wants to be filled. That's why it's so hard to stay minimalist, is there's always something, the pressure is always outside coming in.
Like, yeah.
And it is true that things trigger memories. So you can't discount that. I mean, there's a classic meme about how long do I have to hold on to this birthday card you sent me before it's okay to throw it away. So there's that obligation to honor the gift, and there's the memory that gets triggered by, maybe it's not a gift, maybe it's something you bought, but it triggers that memory of that time. Mm-hmm. So you have to figure out some balance in your life, like how many triggers do I need to have in my house of memories,
right,
before I can no longer get to my bed.
yeah.
What are the important memories, or can we take pictures? Like, it's so hilarious. I went to this rich person's house and they were getting rid of stuff, and this little boy came out and he said, I've already digitized all these memories, so you can take them away now.
No way.
This is a,
oh my God,
we're transitioning to a new species here.
Turning into computers, man. Oh my God. Wow.
But I'm sure that's how his parents convinced him to get rid of those things, because that's a battle I've witnessed. Is, oh, yeah. The mom will come out and be like, okay, I need you to throw this away, but he can't see it. So go put it on the truck right now, 'cause I'm distracting him. So, 'cause if they don't see it, they'll forget about it.
Right.
But as soon as they see you throwing away their ball or
whatever
toy, yeah, it's like, no, I'm not ready to let go of that. So we're all just little kids that, you know, and fighting that urge to hold on to. You become a caretaker to that. And that's what I hear all the time. Oh, don't take it to the dump. Just like, I don't want it. Can you find some place to take it?
Yeah.
I'd rather you take it, you know, because when I first started doing junk removal, there's a dance. If you are excited about something, they decide they don't want to throw it away. But it's over the years, I've started saying, I'm going to charge you, you know, as if it's garbage, and with your permission, I'm going to go through it and take out what I can and recycle it or give it away or sell it. And they nowadays, they're like, oh, that's great. I'd rather it not go to the landfill.
Yeah.
So there's been a paradigm shift in the public's
awareness, awareness of landfills.
Yeah. Landfill is not great.
Not great.
And they have baggage that about just throwing it away. So they're glad to hear that I might sell it.
Right.
So that's been an interesting change.
Where is the landfill here? Like, I know where the dumps are, but where's the actual landfill?
Altamont Pass. They take it up. There's one in Ox Mountain. The closest one would be in Half Moon Bay called Ox Mountain.
Okay.
And you just drive up this big hill of garbage, get to the top.
Wow.
Dump it.
That's so crazy. I think of Half Moon Bay and
so pretty.
It's so gorgeous, man. It's like so,
the prettiest dump used to be in Pacifica. It was called Muscle Beach.
Wow.
And they had, well, that was a transfer station, but it was like right on this point. You know how all those houses are falling into the ocean? It was right on the edge of a cliff, wow. And it was so beautiful, but they closed it.
Are you hopeful or are you, just trying to think about it? Like, how do you feel about the world through the lens of trash and junk?
Well, Amazon and all the online retailers, like I see, look around San Francisco retail. They say retail is dead, right? No, all the major stores are leaving Union Square. The only thing people want to do are pop-ups now, because that's, you can't sustain a day-to-day presence somewhere. People just, they're not interested in that. So it's because everything's so convenient. You just order it online and it comes to your house. So you get out of the house, you go to a pop-up because it's this one time I'll go there and I'll see this stuff and maybe I'll buy something. So shopping is changing, and maybe the quickness of that leads to people buying more stuff, because you order three and you send back two. And I don't know, going to the mall, it would just slow you down. You're like, I have to physically spend 40 minutes getting there.
Right.
Maybe I won't shop there as much.
Try these pants on.
Yeah.
How many people have tried these pants on?
Yeah. So I think it's, if something's easier, then it happens more. So I think there's more shopping, and the quality of goods is going way down, and it's all plastic based, and the, microplastics is in everybody's mind now. Like, oh, this water bottle.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. It's in our minds, figured, literally. So I'm not too hopeful.
Yeah.
About
so no
that.
Hope then.
No. Because I've gone into houses where the recycling never got taken out since the 60s. And it's like the milk came in a cardboard waxed, not petroleum. Maybe it was petroleum wax. I don't know. But it didn't have a foil liner that's impossible to recycle, glued to a petroleum-based wax pack thing with a plastic lid embedded in the thing. That's like a recycling nightmare. That doesn't get recycled.
Mm-mm.
You would have to have a slave labor class to break that down efficiently and make it worth it. So I guess we got to start advocating for slavery again of some, and that's what's happening. They're going to take away all the good jobs with AI, and
right.
The only thing left for all of us
is just toil.
It's just breaking down our garbage.
Yeah. Which will hopefully make us all not want to. I mean, just the thing you showed me today, you showed me this like canvas bag that was what a pair of snow chains came in.
Yeah.
You know, the packaging, like you and I are of the age where like glass Coca-Cola, everything was in glass. There was no plastic bottles. I don't remember plastic bottles until like maybe late 80s, early 90s.
And it was just the 2 liters.
Yeah, it was just 2 liters.
And then they made them personal sized.
And then bottled water.
Yeah.
Like if you would have told us as children, hey, the number one thing that people are going to buy is bottled water.
Because we're all so scared of tap water, and you can't go to a stream and drink it because that seems like it's dirty.
Right.
So.
And all the water fountains. Those got licked out of the public discourse. Well, anyway, so I'm sorry. I know I've had you here for an hour already. But I really like what you're doing. I think it's super cool. I like your relationship with like archival things, giving a shit about trash, keeping things out of landfills, honoring the story. I mean, the fact that you go there and you give a shit about the stuff and you're not just chucking it. Which, I mean, there's some chucking.
There will be chucking. Yeah.
But, like, you have a sensitivity to it. And I mean, I hate that I keep meeting people on Instagram, but it is what it is, man.
It's where we go now.
It's where we go. It's, I'm sure it's passe now. There's some other place for people younger than us go hang out.
TikTok, yeah.
Yeah. But to have like seen what you're up to and been able to connect with you on it, I think it's cool for me. And I don't know. I just want you to succeed however that looks for you, and keep doing what it is that you're doing, because I think it's really cool. It's a good thing.
Yes. Thank you. I want to ask you to maybe explain that more. Like, people do seem to get really excited about this job, and it's odd to me because it's basically like the difference between me and the garbage man that comes once a week is that I'm sorting it out and trying to save something, and that makes me a folk hero, I feel like, maybe. Is that what it is?
It's that. I mean, it's also like, you know, now miners, you think of slavery and like horrible conditions, but you know, there was like something poetic about mining.
It's just hard, dirty work.
Dirty, hard work, and you're looking for diamonds, or you're looking for that valuable thing and the whatever. So you're doing a form of mining, which is, it's got its own poetic weight to it. So there's that. I mean, the difference between you and trash, you got to call, you're a by appointment concierge trash man. So that's like you're an upper echelon trash man. But it's not just junk because of the way you treat it. You know, like that you have a staff of people that, I mean, you're creating jobs out of people's detritus. You're, in a weird way, like anytime there's a tragedy, the many things that draw you in, right, that draw your service in, there's the many stages of grief, right, of dealing with a thing.
Anger, and, denial, yeah.
Right, but they don't talk about stuff and junk that doesn't make it in to the stages of grief. You're that other guy. You're that last component that never makes it into the 12 steps. You're the 13th step. And I think to me, that's why I think it's compelling. You are I'm moving stuff out of your house, but there's another component to it that you like 1-800-JUNK. There's no story that nobody gives a shit. And there might be the occasional employee who's just a sensitive dude, but for the most part, it's not like a particularly, you know, personalized thing.
Yeah.
You're one dude with a truck who, by reputation, you're not out buying ads on, you know, sides of buses and stuff. You know, you developed relationships with real estate agents and probate or whatever attorneys.
Yeah.
Like that's hip. You know, to me, that's what makes it unique. And that, you know, just like an artist who would be making garbage out into art, a DJ who finds old records, you know, just someone who can appreciate the way things were made and try to share that with other people. That's my long-winded explanation of why I think what you do is cool. Does that cut the mustard?
Yeah. I guess I want to bring people more of what they find interesting. So just honoring the story, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. You're honoring the story, and the story's still good.
Right. I got to correct you. It's not just one guy in a truck anymore.
Well,
I have three hardworking guys that make it all happen for me out there on the trucks.
Nice. Oh, you got multiple trucks. It's not just one truck?
Right. Yeah, I have a dump truck and a box truck.
Nice.
And a pickup truck. And I have two other box trucks that I used to have a bigger crew before COVID, but downtown literally closed down.
Yeah.
Yeah. At COVID, and I don't go back there anymore. So I lost two guys and a truck. So.
Well, I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
You do have a small fleet, but it is a very small, it's very still boutique.
It is boutique.
And I would imagine you probably put some thought into the dudes that work for you.
Yeah. Especially Mike. Yeah. He's been with me a long time, all through COVID, weathered the storm. And he's a sensitive dude. And he's a Berkeley graduate. So I'm like, what is wrong with you? Why are you working with me here? And he's like, I just like the stuff. It's a good, I like to recycle.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, thanks for pumping up my ego and coming down and asking me questions like I matter. That's really cool.
Most definitely, man. Cheers. Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Anybody seen the old young man picking up all the junk he can? Nobody knows what he's about till you hear him holler and shout. Any rags, old box today, that is what you hear him say. Buy soap, clothes, and hot water bags. He's out in the alley, hot boxes and rags.